So I figure there must be a good number of you here from the QCD program, but I wrote this talk assuming, I think correctly, that the audience would be broader. And so I may spend some of the time boring the QCD people, but hopefully it will be interesting to everyone. Because there is a fairly convoluted story here with a fairly convoluted history, I think I should start, in fact, with the history. So in 1973, David and his friends discovered asymptotic freedom and established then that QCD was the theory of the strong interaction. Now, QCD is, asymptotic freedom is nice because it means that at high energy, the theory is weakly coupled, and you can really do calculations in terms of nearly free quarks and gluons and really match the calculations to experiment and see that you've got the right theory. But there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens at low energy, like bound states and especially quark confinement, for which you'd like to have some quantitative understanding and even a conceptual understanding in case of quark confinement, and perturbation theory breaks down. And so people went looking for new tools, and within a year, in fact, a couple of new tools came along. One of them is lattice gauge theory due to Wilson, which has been useful both as an analytic and a numerical approximation to QCD. And the other is the large N limit due to a Tuft, and that's the one I'll more focus on. So the large N limit means the following. QCD is based on a gauge group SU3, that's three colors. Imagine instead that one had a large number of colors. There are a lot of field theories. So a large number of colors means, in particular, that there's a large number of gluons. There are what are n squared gluons. There are a lot of field theories which become solvable in the limit of a large number of fields like this. A lot of field theories, even field theories which have interesting dynamics like QCD, where in the large n limit you can do some kind of mean field approximation, averaging over all the fields and really get a quantitative solution. Now, unfortunately, QCD gauge theory is not in that category. In some sense, even as you take the number of colors to be large, the number of mean fields that you would need to capture the dynamics remains very large, and so things don't immediately become simple. But they do simplify somewhat. So let me draw a couple of Feynman graphs here. That's a couple of quarks exchanging a couple of gluons. There's one picture, and here's another picture where the gluons cross. And actually, for the purpose of thinking about the large N limit, the gluons are matrices under color. They have two indices. The quarks are fundamentals, vector-like, and have one index. And so it's useful to adopt a notation due to a Tuft in which I draw a single line for the quark and a double line for the gluons. And so this Feynman graph looks like that. And this Feynman graph then is a little harder to draw. So I cheated. I'm not going to get it right. There. Okay. This Feynman graph looks like that. And in the large N limit, these are of different magnitudes. This one, which they cross, is suppressed by two powers of the large number. And this is the pattern that Atuf pointed out, that graphs appear in the expansion according to their topology, and in particular, the leading order, the order that would survive in the limit of large N, is all graphs that can be drawn on the plane like this with no crossings. So I could start to dress this with more gluons, but as long as none of the gluons cross each other, so I can draw it in the plane, it still is leading order in N. And so the large N limit requires that we sum all of these planar graphs. And that's still a lot of graphs, and there's no especially nice pattern to them. And so although the perturbation theory has simplified, again, it doesn't immediately become solvable. I should say that one of the things that makes the large n limit particularly interesting is that it appears that in practical terms, 3 is a fairly large number, because there are a lot of patterns in the phenomenology of QCD which in fact look like the large n limit. So there are a lot of things which are suppressed in the large n limit, things that would be due to non-planar graphs, in fact, do seem to be smaller in real QCD. And so if you could, in fact, solve the theory in this limit, you would have not only a very nice result, but also something that was a fairly good quantitative model of real QCD. So Atuft didn't then solve the theory, but what he did notice was that this topological pattern is very similar to a topological pattern that is seen elsewhere. If you think about a string and imagine it just moving forward in time, propagating, its world sheet is topologically like that. Strings, though, can also, in addition to sitting there and wiggling, pieces of them can break off. So I can imagine a world sheet where sort of a little loop breaks off and reattaches, and I get a handle attached. That's a loop. And now I've emitted and absorbed a little loop of string here. So in some expansion, this is higher order than this. This is of order g squared. And so what Atuft conjectured was that in the large n limit, in the 1 over n expansion, the expansion around n equals infinity, gauge theory becomes a string theory. What you can kind of imagine is that all of the summing over all of the Feynman graphs of this topology will kind of build up a dense mesh. And that dense mesh can be then reinterpreted as a continuous world sheet, a continuous world history. And similarly, as you go to higher and higher orders in the 1 over n expansion, the topology of Feynman graphs that you get exactly matches onto the topology of string histories, string world sheets, where you emit and absorb more and more pieces of string.
I'm Joe,
yes.
Coupling constant, but I forgot which one.
Okay, sorry. So I should thank you. I should, let me call this G sub string to be very explicit, because there's going to be another coupling constant later on. So I haven't talked at all about the coupling of the gauge theory yet, and I'll talk about that later on. So far, I'm just matching n, the number of colors to the gauge theory, with the coupling constant of the string theory. And later on, there'll be actually a two parameters to match between the two sides. Now, that's really nice. However, this idea had actually been tried. There is some prehistory here. It had been tried, and it didn't work before we knew about QCD or before we were sure about it. People were looking at a model, for example, we now know that a pion, a meson, is like a quark and an anti-quark, and there's a color force between them, and because of confinement, the color force doesn't spread out to become real Coulombic, but is more or less tube-like in certain limits. And here's a string, and they look sort of the same. So it's not surprising that before we knew what the truth was, there were a bunch of people trying this idea and finding that indeed in some regimes of energy and so on, the phenomenology of this looks a lot like the real strong interaction.
But the history is a lot weirder than that. In the history, you didn't have the left-hand side.
Right.
You didn't have the right-hand side.
Well, that's true, too. This is a cartoon of the history. Yes.
The underlying conceptual underlay of the history.
This is the part of the this is the cartoon of the history which is relevant to the present talk.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, yes.
What did Tebbuk think? I mean, Tebbuk knew that this earlier attempt hadn't succeeded.
Yes.
And yet here he is proposing that as a string theory. So what did he say about all
of the proposal was very offhand. You know, it was dense fiber diagrams.
Yeah, it was.
Whatever,
yeah, yeah.
What's the relation between the thickness of the string and lambda QCD?
In fact, good. So in some artificial limit where I pull the quark and anti-quark far apart and suppress pair creation that would let it break, so I can actually talk about the dynamics of string, QCD has only one scale. So this is lambda QCD. The tension, the size, everything are lambda QCD. And presumably there is lattice gauge theory data that would actually put a number on that, though I don't know.
And the number is surprisingly small. It's about 0.2 kelvins. It's very thin.
It's thin for no real parametric reason. It's just thin for the heck of it, and so therefore string theory is better than it should be almost. Right. Good.
Which you know from the original historical origin of that string theory, which was the straight line Reggie trajectory, which is an astounding experimental fact. Like, you know, you have 8 particles on a straight line trajectory, which is exactly what you get in a mathematically thin string theory.
Okay. But thin as it is, the thickness is not zero. And in many regimes, they don't look the same. In particular, at high energy, so I want to list some of the differences. At high energy, it becomes evident that the meson is made up of points, partons, zero-dimensional objects, whereas the string really has a smooth one-dimensional distribution of energy momentum, and its behavior is qualitatively very different at high energy. So string theory doesn't have partons. Secondly, if you really try to quantize a mathematically zero thickness one-dimensional object, it's highly constrained. There are infinities that you've got to worry about, anomalies, and you don't have a lot of free parameters. The theory forces certain things on you. In fact, it forces on you massless spin one and spin two fields, which you don't have in QCD. And it also forces on you 10 dimensions. Yes? Replace the string by, sorry?
Decker-Williams.
By Decker-Williams? No, sir?
Gluons, yeah.
Why can't I boost this and turn it into gluons? Sorry, I misunderstood the question.
The left string.
Left string.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean, it is gluon. I mean, in some, obviously, this is the thing which at high energy looks like gluons. String theory doesn't, by string theory, I mean here, the theory of one, truly one-dimensional objects, not objects which have some kind of thickness and underlying structure, but the actual quantized theory of truly one-dimensional objects doesn't have partons. And surprisingly, you're forced to have certain massless spinning particles, and also, again, surprisingly, and it's a long story, but has again to do with the infinities of the object inside the internal infinities of the object itself, that it has to live in 10 dimensions. So even before asymptotic freedom came along and provided the right theory, this idea was failing through its own internal lack of being QCD. So, however, once again, 1974 was a busy year because once it was understood what the strong interaction was, Shirk and Schwartz, and I'm sure others, looked at this list and said, hey, string theory is good for something else. And so also in 1974, we had Shirk and Schwartz proposing that string theory was a theory of gravity, which, of course, started the chain of events that we're still following today. Okay, still, Tufts' argument was very compelling, and over the years, people have gone back and tried to push the Large End Approximation further. I should mention, by the way, that also in lattice gauge theory, the strong coupling expansion gives you something string-like. It gives you the path integral becomes a sum over surfaces, which looks just like a sum over string world sheets. What this really has to do with this is the fact that the flux lines of non-abelian gauge theory provide a one-dimensional structure, which in both of these approximations sort of dominates helps to organize the theory. And so over the years, we've gone back to this, and in a few toy models, the Large End Approximation has been understood better. But I think it was always assumed that because of these differences, whatever string theory Tufts was looking for was going to be very different from the string theory of gravity. It would probably be more complicated and uglier and certainly different. And for a very long time after Tufts, there was no really substantial progress until 1997, when Maldacena, in effect, solved his conjecture and showed that the string theory that he wanted was not something new and different. It was the same string theory that is being used to describe gravity, but just in a different and rather unusual space-time background. So that was what he showed, Large End Gauge Theory. So that's a great surprise. So what I want to do next is to talk about the idea of duality, which provides kind of the is the key idea in this connection, and then to talk more specifically about the two sides of this particular duality. So. In one sense, what duality is that we're used to the idea of breaking up a Hamiltonian into a solvable part and a part that we hope that we can treat as small and thereby make a perturbation expansion. But in fact, it turns out to be a rather common phenomenon that one theory can have many different perturbation expansions. That is, you can break the Hamiltonian up in many very different ways. And in particular, in the most simplest and most interesting case, the new coupling constant might be the reciprocal of the old. So that when the original coupling G is enormous and the original perturbation expansion is maximally useless, one has a precise rewriting of the quantum field theory in terms of some new set of variables in which there's a useful perturbation in terms of G prime. One example of this comes in supersymmetric gauge theories, where at weak coupling, well, there are the basic quanta of the theory, the point-like electric charges that you get by quantizing the fields. But in general, in non-abelian gauge theories, there are also solitons, big, heavy, fuzzy things, which carry magnetic charge, magnetic monopoles. When you take that same theory and instead consider the case that the coupling is very large, well, as you turn up the coupling, the electric charges are going to start to emit more and more photons, more and more gauge bosons. They're going to be They're going to be surrounded by a cloud of virtual stuff. And of course, you wouldn't be surprised if at strong coupling, the electric objects begin to look big and fuzzy. What was conjectured and now is strongly believed to be true, though, is that for the magnetic objects, exactly the opposite happens. So as you turn up the coupling, as your original description becomes less and less quantitatively and qualitatively useful, in fact, the solitons get lighter, smaller, and in the large coupling limit, there's in fact a dual description in which you expand in the reciprocal coupling. The basic variables are magnetically charged fields, and so H naught here describes the motion of free electric objects. H naught prime describes the motion of free magnetic objects.
There is running. You cannot use one or the other.
If there is running, okay. In the simplest cases where this is true, the coupling doesn't run, and we can actually. I'm going to be drawing couplings versus energy later on, so we can talk more about that then. But in the simplest cases where this is true, the beta function is zero and the coupling are the same at all energies, and so this is a scale invariant statement. Right. There are lots of interesting dualities in theories with running couplings, but the story is more intricate. Now, the real prototype for this is a bunch of examples in 1 plus 1 space-time dimensions, like the Ising model and the Sine-Gordon-Tiering duality, where you really know how to change variables from this form to this form. It's an old story, and one knows how to manipulate the path integral from one form to the other. Even today, even after we strongly believe that this is true in a wide class of field theories, it's really kind of remarkable that we don't, in fact, know how to do it at the operator level, how to really carry out the change of variables in the path integral. I'm not sure whether this is a major defect or not. The reason we believe this is due to a large amount of indirect and circumstantial evidence. Most of it has to do with supersymmetry. So in supersymmetry, one has some kind of pairing between fermions and bosons. So here's some kind of quantum correction with a Fermi loop. Here's some kind of quantum correction with a Bose loop. And in certain amplitudes, not in all amplitudes, these things add to zero. The quantum corrections due to virtual fermions and virtual bosons cancel. This is one of the things that makes supersymmetry interesting both phenomenologically as a possible for its connection to symmetry breaking in the weak interaction. It also makes it mathematically very rich. And again, these are not trivial quantum field theories. They've got lots of quantum corrections, but in carefully chosen masses and amplitudes, the quantum corrections vanish, and so you can do exact calculations. Exact means you're not using perturbation theory. You can do calculations which are valid at all couplings. And using this, you can piece together enough of the strong coupling physics to see that it looks exact, basically to see that this is happening. You can't prove it's happening, but what you can see is enough that everything that you can calculate about the strongly coupled limit looks exactly like what you would get from the dual perturbation expansion. And this seems to be a very general phenomenon that is in a wide class of supersymmetric theories. That one of the things that makes it so dependable is the fact that it seems to work not just in isolated examples, but all over the place in many field theories. So here I'm talking about a duality between two different quantum field theories, two different gauge theories, but also between different string theories. So that's field. Now, in string theory, one of the notable facts about string theory is, again, when you go to really try to quantize mathematically thin one-dimensional objects, you find that to make a consistent quantum theory, you need that they just not only vibrate in sort of physical bosonic space, but they have some additional fermionic degrees of freedom on them. They vibrate in the superspace. And there's basically five different ways to do this. There's five different string theories, five completely different perturbative expansions. There was always kind of a suspicion that You know, 5 was kind of a funny number, and maybe these were all either all connected to each other in some way, that there was some equivalence between them. And in fact, there is. And up until 1995, when all we had in, essentially all we had in string theory was the perturbation theory, there was no real clue as to what the connection is. And then as soon as we began to understand that duality was a generic phenomenon and that you could test it, analyze it in these different simple ways, Hull, Townsend, and Witten very quickly showed that the 5 string theories were all, in fact, different limits of a single theory. The picture I like to draw. So the theories had various names, 2A, 2B, type 1, heterotic, and the other heterotic. And this is here the parameter space, in some sense, the coupling constant space. I could say more about what this parameter space is, but I don't want to right now. But in some sense, this is a two-dimensional coupling constant space. And as you go to certain limits, in those limits, the string theory is, the theory is described by the perturbation expansion for one or the other of these string theories. So it's a duality, but it's really, I guess, a pentality because there's 5 of them. And it's really much more than that because there are many, many limits and many, many different perturbation expansions that you can reach. In the middle, things are complicated, and there's still no simple quantitative description. You really can think of this as being closely analogous to a phase diagram. You have a theory, and as you vary the parameters, and the different string theories as being phases, as you vary the parameters, there are different regions of parameter space where there are different, qualitatively different descriptions, and they turn into each other. Also, as you vary the parameters, you can find new phases that you had no way to discover before. And in particular, there are many such new phases. The most famous is D equals Levin supergravity. Now, I should emphasize this is really just kind of a slice through a much larger and more complicated phase diagram describing the most symmetric states in the theory. In particular, in this picture I'm envisioning, there are no discontinuous phase transitions, just continuous changes from one kind of behavior to another.
Crossovers,
right. But in fact, as I said, this is a slice of a much more complicated diagram. It's huge. It has many parameters, many components which intersect each other, and so on. It's a just imagine something like a nightmare, you know, and just many different kinds of phases. And we now have the tools since 1995 for determining that phase diagram. So it's a vastly, you know, higher level of understanding of the theory than just having perturbation theory. These two, I should say, supersymmetry plays an important role, at least initially, in discovering and verifying these dualities. But once you have a duality between two supersymmetric theories, in many, many cases, you can perturb and find dualities between theories that are less supersymmetric or not supersymmetric at all. And in fact, in some sense, what we're still doing is enlarging the phase diagram by understanding the parts of it that correspond to less symmetric theories or less symmetric states. Okay, so this is field-field duality, just electromagnetic interchange. Here's string-string duality, or I should call it string-string-M duality, since there are phases like this one that have no strings in them at all. There are no identifiable one-dimensional excitations in this limit. It seems funny to call the whole thing string theory, and so now we often call it M theory. Okay, but there's another duality. What Juan has discovered, Aldesina, is field string duality, where one side of the duality is a field theory, and the other side is a string theory. And now I want to be a bit more specific about what gauge theory I'm talking about. So in a gauge theory, we have the spin 1 vector fields, and we have some collection of spin 1/2 and spin 0 matter. And in general, the matter couples to the gauge fields in different ways, in different representations. But I can focus on two here, the adjoint or matrix representation and the fundamental or one index vector representation. So we always have gauge bosons in the adjoint representation. That's what a gauge theory is. For real QCD, the other thing we have is quarks, spin 1/2 fields in the fundamental. But I want to think here about the entire class of gauge theories, large N gauge theories, and not specifically about QCD. And in fact, the theory which has the simplest duality, the most symmetric theory, has a specific collection of matter fields, both spin 0 and spin 1/2. And the point here is that there is a supersymmetry, a symmetry that connects the different columns in the table. In fact, there's a lot of supersymmetry. The theory for which Maldacena's theory has 16 conserved supersymmetry generators. In four dimensions, and I should say all of my field theories for the purpose of this discussion are in four dimensions. In four dimensions, by Lorentz invariants, supersymmetries come in sets of four. So having 16 supersymmetries is four copies of the minimal set, four sets. Curly N equals 4 supersymmetry. So on the left-hand side of the duality is this N equals 4 supersymmetry. And on the, excuse me a sec. Okay, I thought there was something I meant to say. On the right-hand side is one of those five supersymmetries, the 2B string theory, in a funny space, ADS5 cross S5. ADS5 is some kind of hyperbolic space, kind of like that. And S5 is a sphere. Again, string theory needs to live in 10 dimensions. So that's the original duality. Now, this gauge theory, in addition to having a lot of supersymmetry, has other special properties. In particular, with this particular set of fields, the beta function is 0. The coupling doesn't run. The loops of bosons cancel the loops of fermions. So I want to plot the gauge couplings. First of all, for QCD, which is the theory we'd like to understand, it's weakly coupled at high energy, and then the coupling blows up at some scale. So this is energy, and this is the gauge coupling. And when we're letting the number of colors vary, it's useful to talk in terms of G squared. And YM here is Yang-Mills to distinguish it from the string coupling, which is something else. I guess this should also be G Yang-Mills. So there'll be two coupling constants. There's the Yang-Mills coupling, and there's going to be the string coupling again. Anyway, when the gauge coupling, so the gauge coupling, of course, does this with energy. And what I've just said is that the theories with the first, which were the first examples of gauge string duality, have a coupling which is constant with scale. So this is the N equals 4 theory, and this is QCD. Again, this is because the loops of gluons dominate, and they give a sign that the coupling gets weak at high energy. In this case, the spectrum is such that the corrections of fermions and bosons cancel to every order in perturbation theory and also exactly. So QCD has a scale. QCD has a scale. This is where the binding occurs. This is a scale of quark confinement and the baryon masses and so on. And the N equals 4 gauge theory does not have a scale. It's scale invariant. It has no mass no characteristic mass scale. Its physics is the same at all scales. Actually, in the case of QCD, there's not really a coupling constant. That is, there's only one theory because different values of the coupling just correspond to different points along this curve. The coupling is this axis, and so there's only one curve you can be on. You can just be at different places along it. That's dimensional transmutation. There is no dimensionless coupling, whereas the conformally invariant, the supersymmetric theory here, there is a dimensionless parameter because that's a different theory. That's a theory with a different coupling constant. So there's a dimensionless parameter we don't have in QCD. Now, this is a strange assertion. All of the dualities are strange. I mean, it's remarkable. I have to say, it's remarkable that a soliton can do this. You know, a big fuzzy thing, as you turn up the coupling, gets smaller and simpler. That's remarkable enough. It's even more remarkable that an ordinary four-dimensional quantum field theory with just some extra fields, that its degrees of freedom can organize themselves in some limit into a string theory, and a string theory in some strange special space. I meant to say how this was discovered. Well, in fact, this space is the geometry near the horizon of certain kinds of black holes. There's another whole branch of this story having to do with the quantum mechanics of black holes and the information problem. But in any case, a number of people were looking at scattering of strings near the horizons of black holes. And what was noticed was an interesting pattern where a lot of things that you calculated just using strings and geometry over here turned out to be the same as calculations that you did over here in a very different language, totally different kind of calculation in terms of Feynman graphs. And the interpretation of the fact that two different kinds of calculations were giving the same answer, again, was a duality. These are the same theory in two different limits. And what is the parameter that controls the two limits, I'll tell you in a second. But again, it's in this same framework I was describing earlier, where due to supersymmetry, you can deduce certain exact properties of the strongly coupled theory and make comparisons. So that's how this was found.
But would it be true to say that you'd only notice this sort of thing if you had theories that you could sum Feynman diagrams to all order? Because typically, if you weren't able to do that, you throw out some bits in one half and other bits in the other, and they'd never look the same.
I think in all of the known dualities, they're obtained, all the ones I know of, Either it's very simple things like the Ising model, where you really can, you know, manipulate everything completely, or you start with a supersymmetric theory where, again, you can't solve at high energy, but where you can solve subsectors of it at high energy, and then perturbing on that. So that's the primary strategy, to start with a theory where you have some kind of independent strong coupling information. Just taking the Hamiltonian and trying changes of variables has never led anywhere. That was tried briefly in the late 70s, and you very quickly get a mess. And so for that reason, in fact, there was a great deal of skepticism about this conjecture for a very long time. Like, it was widely, the conjecture goes back to the late 70s, and until 95 or the early 90s, the general reaction was that it was not plausible. Now I want to say more, so that's the gauge side. I want to say more about the supergravity side. You see, I'm doing on time, doing well. So what I want to do is say, there's a limit to how much I can say in the time, but I do want to just try to make a few points of contact between these two things, because right now, I haven't told you much about either, but they certainly don't look at all the same. So to start to make them look the same, let me write the metric of ADS5 here in a particular set of coordinates, x, mu, and r. So mu runs over 0 up to 3, the usual four dimensions. Okay, so five coordinates for a five-dimensional space. Four coordinates that you can identify with the usual four coordinates, with the four coordinates of the gauge theory, and a fifth radial coordinate that I've got to tell you more about. Capital R here is another parameter. And I'm going to save it. Again, I have to tell you about all the parameters and how they match up, but that has to wait a minute. So for now, R is some fixed parameter with dimensions of length. So I guess I can pencil that in here. That's R. R is the radius of the sphere, and R is the scale of the hyperboloid. Now, this space has a lot of symmetry, more than is manifest from the way I've written the metric. It has the obvious Lorentz invariance and translation invariance of these four x coordinates, which maps to the symmetries of the gauge theory. Now, as I emphasize, this gauge theory has this additional symmetry of scale invariance. It has no, it has, for whatever value of the coupling, it has no intrinsic scale. The physics looks the same on all scales. Over here, that is reflected by the fact that there's a symmetry of this metric. You can rescale the x coordinates, making them bigger. And if you make the little r coordinates smaller, then the first term is invariant, and the second term is invariant. And so the scale invariance of the gauge theory is reflected in the an isometry of this spacetime. And similarly, like, there are some obvious rotational symmetries of the phi sphere, which map to flavor symmetries, global symmetries of the gauge theory, and the symmetries match up nicely between the two sides. The second thing is something to do with energy scales and holography. So in this theory over here, there's an obvious characteristic scale. As I've shown you in the picture, the space has some size. And so the characteristic energy for some cavity mode in this space is going to be the inverse to that. Okay, that characteristic energy is over on the supergravity side, the gauge theory, the string theory side over here. There is no characteristic scale in the gauge theory, and so we've got to figure out how this characteristic scale is reflected over here. Well, note the important thing about this metric from the point of view of a four-dimensional physicist is that the scale, the normalization of the metric, depends strongly on where you are in the fifth dimension, the radial dimension. There is a gravitational redshift which varies strongly across the fifth dimension. So in particular, if you had a clock which was ticking at some invariant rate, and you moved the clock around in this radial dimension, and then you're sort of a four-dimensional physicist at some fixed position looking at that clock, it's going to be running very, very fast when it's out here from your point of view, and very, very slow when it's in here from your point of view. There's a gravitational redshift. Okay. What that means in terms of energies is, so the energy as seen by a four-dimensional observer is just the conjugate to the time coordinate. The reason for that is because this metric is invariant under time translation. That's a killing vector. The corresponding global conserved energy is just the coordinate energy. But because the metric depends on R, this is related to the energy seen by a local observer by some redshift. And plugging in this characteristic energy scale for what the local observer sees. So what's happening is that different energy scales in the four-dimensional theory are being mapped into different in some rough way, because it's a characteristic scale, it's not a precise statement. Different energy scales in the four-dimensional theory are being mapped into the five-dimensional geometry in this way, what you might think from the four-dimensional point of view as a renormalization group scale, but is now stretched out in front of you as an actual fifth coordinate. It's still remarkable that a 3+1-dimensional theory is supposed to be physically the same as a 9+1-dimensional theory. you would think that you could tell the difference between them in some obvious way. You could just turn your head and count the number of ways you can turn it. But what's happening at one level is that because the gauge theory has a very large number of fields, one is in the large n limit, it turns out that there is a hidden locality in field space. And the extra locality, the extra directions that you get from the that you see in this picture are in some sense emerging from the large number of fields that you have over in the gauge theory. That's based.
The duality is not alleged to be only true in the
end. Okay, when we get to the third thing I have to say is the matching of parameters, and that would be a good time to mention that again. But in any case, that's where the dimension is coming from. But in particular, this one, the radial dimension, is encoded in the gauge theory in this very funny way, mapping scale into energy. This kind of mapping is sometimes called holographic. One reason for that is we're accustomed to thinking in quantum field theory that the most fundamental things are at the shortest distances and the highest energies. And according to this mapping, the highest energies in the gauge theory are identified with the boundary of the ADS5, R equals infinity. So by the way, the range for this coordinate R is 0 to infinity. 0, where clocks slow down and stop, is like the horizon of a black hole. It takes an infinite amount of time to fall into it. Infinity actually is a finite distance away. You can send signals there in a finite time. So this is more like a finite-sized box in the radial direction. But anyway, it's holographic in the sense that the local variables of the gauge theory, in some sense, are mapped to the boundary of the space. Now, when you have a duality, when you have two theories that look very different but are the same, you learn a lot. Information flows in both directions because usually there are things that you can calculate on one side that you can't calculate on the other in both ways, both directions, and so again, information flows both ways. Here, where you have two theories which are really extremely different from one another, that information flow is especially interesting. Now, in the case of string theory, it's still true that we really don't know what the theory is. We don't really know what the Hamiltonian string theory is, or even what variables it's constructed out of. We don't know the central defining principle, the analog of the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics and the equivalence principle in general relativity. It seems very likely that a part of the story has to do with the fact that space-time coordinates, space-time itself, is not fundamental, which is not too surprising, but that whatever is fundamental is really non-local in a surprisingly drastic way. And one of the names that has been given to this property is the holographic principle, which again refers to the idea that, like a hologram, the entire information in the higher dimensional bulk in the space of the space is encoded on its lower dimensional boundary. And we still don't understand what the holographic principle is in all contexts, but this duality gives a very precise realization of the holographic principle for string theory in this special background, or more generally, in geometries which look like this at infinity, the metric can fluctuate freely in the interior. So that's using the duality in the direction of using the gauge theory to understand the string theory. But for the purpose of the rest of this talk, I want to go in the opposite direction and use the string theory to understand the gauge theory in the fashion that a Tuft proposed. So now I finally have to tell you about the matching of parameters. Okay, so first of all, there is the Yang-Mills coupling, which is dimensionless in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And this is essentially equal to, the square of this is essentially equal to the string coupling. And I want, for the sake of this discussion, to imagine that that's small. We can relax that. But just to keep things simple, I want to imagine that that's small, and I don't have to worry about quantum corrections in the string coupling. The other two parameters are n. So the gauge theory has a coupling, and it has a number of colors. I'm going to consider those two combinations. And on the string side, the other dimensionless thing we have is the size of this space in units of the basic scale of the string theory. And it's this, so I want to keep these fixed as small. I want to focus on what happens as I vary. So this dimensionless parameter between being large and being small. First of all, so the counting is working. The number of dimensionless parameters is agreeing. When that parameter is large, it means that the gauge theory is strongly coupled. The actual thing that governs the loop expansion in the gauge theory is not Gyang Mill squared, but Gyang Mill squared n when you count the group theory weight. So when this is large, you can't calculate in the gauge theory. It's strongly coupled. When this is large, though, it means that the characteristic radius of this space is large compared to a string. And actually, you can go to an approximation where the string is basically a point, and you go to the low energy field theory limit, and you calculate in the effective low energy supergravity theory, and use the effective low energy supergravity theory to calculate things that you wouldn't know how to calculate in gauge theory. So when this is large, the gauge theory is strong, but the string theory is weak, or the string theory description is good. When this is small, then, in fact, you could just use the ordinary Feynman graph expansion for the gauge theory. Just the lowest few graphs give the answer to good approximation. And it had better be, well, the gauge theory is weak. And the string theory, then, had better go crazy, because a string if the theory is described by just ordinary perturbative gluons, it doesn't look like this picture. It doesn't look like strings moving in a space like that. It's characteristic of these dualities that there's a complementarity, that in some limit, one picture is good quantitatively and qualitatively, the other one is not, and vice versa. What goes wrong is this. In this limit, where this parameter is small, the size of this space is small compared to a string. So here's my space, and here's my string. And how do I put this in that? Well, in principle, it must exist, but it's complicated. It's complicated in a specific way. The motion of the string is described by a 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory, because the string is a 1 dimensional object. And what happens is, in this limit where the string is large compared to the radius of curvature, that worldsheet theory, the theory on the string, becomes strongly coupled. So early on, I turned off the process of strings breaking apart and rejoining. But even on the string itself, just the wiggles are strongly coupled. So the worldsheet theory is weak when the radius is large, and the worldsheet theory is strong when the radius is small. So there's the matching, and coming back to Kurt's point about finite n. At finite n, it's obvious that if this is small, if n is small, then if this is small, this is small. And so we're always in this regime where the space is highly curved. The duality is still presumably true. These things tend to be very robust. And if they're true in one range of parameters, they tend to be true sort of maximally extended. But as yet, it's not useful because we don't know what to do. We've created a problem of a 3 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory, which might be strongly coupled, for a 1 dimensional quantum field theory, which is strongly coupled. Yes? Oh, so. Okay. in particular, actually, just to give you one more equation, the world sheet coupling, the thing which governs the perturbation theory on the world sheet, is the strings, the characteristic string size squared divided by the radius squared. So when the radius squared is large, you've got a good perturbation theory on the world sheet. When the radius is small, you don't. But when the radius is small, you have a good perturbation theory over in the gauge theory. And so there's this complementarity. So I'm in good shape as far as time, because everything I've said so far about Maldacena's duality, about the field string duality, was for this highly supersymmetric scale invariant field theory. But again, once we understand a duality in some very simple context, you can perturb both sides. In particular, you can sort of either continuously or by clever leaps of guesswork go from the duality we've discussed to some duality in a to some less symmetric gauge theory. And what you find is that the dual string theory is correspondingly the same string theory. You can't change that. There's only one string theory. Well, it's only whatever. There's not a lot of stuff. There's no parameters that it change. What you change is the space-time geometry. So in particular, let me not worry now about adding quarks in. There are various ways to do that. But let me just sort of set as a goal the large n limit for just pure glue, which is still a rich and interesting theory. The theory I'm describing differs from pure glue by having those additional spin a half and spin zero fields. So one way, simplest conceptual way, to get rid of them is to give them a mass. So we have, again, spin one, spin a half, spin zero. And let's just give these all some mass m and take the mass to infinity. Well, let's take it to infinity slowly. So here again is my energy and my coupling. And if this mass were large, then what I have at low energy is just the glue, which is asymptotically free, and I get a curve like QCD. And then I reach, so here's lambda. And then I reach the scale m where where I see these fields, and above that scale, it's as though they were massless, and so it goes over to the other kind of curve. So I have at low energy QCD-like evolution, and at high energy, the scale invariant supersymmetric theory. And again, I can sort of draw several versions of this curve, but I want to put the problem is, from the point of view of really getting quantitative information about the large n limit of QCD, in order to have a useful string dual, in order to have a string dual in which I know how to calculate, I need that the parameter g squared n be large, and I need that it be large at all energy scales. If it's small anywhere. I've got large curvatures, and there's no clean way right now to handle things. So the theories for which I have a quantitative string representation have coupling constants that look like this. They're QCD-like for a tiny bit, and then very quickly they turn off, and the coupling becomes scale invariant, which is to say that the mass scale of these additional fields is essentially the same as the confinement scale. So you have a theory which is like QCD at low energy. It has confinement, chiral symmetry breaking. But at high energy, instead of being asymptotically free, it's described by some kind of non-trivial fixed point, some kind of scale invariant but strongly interacting dynamics for the quarks and gluons. If you try to increase m, like to here or to here, to get to real QCD, you run into the problem that the coupling curve drops below 1. Once it drops below 1, you're in the other limit where the gauge theory is useful. The string theory is not. And you really have the problem is that the gauge theory is strong here, the string theory is strong here, and we as yet have no nice way to to graft those together. So we cannot make the extra matter decouple. By the way, for those of you who've been following this at a distance, shortly after Maldacena's work, there were constructions along these lines where the high energy theory was the same story. That is, there's a scale invariant theory that starts just above the confinement scale. But in the first construction, this conformal theory was actually 5 plus 1 dimensional. It was a higher dimensional theory. And so the extra stuff, the extra fields that don't decouple are actually Kaluza-Klein fields. And so one heard reference to the Kaluza-Klein states not decoupling. It's now better than that. I guess basically work that I did with Matt Strassler 2 years ago and also Klebanoff and Strassler showed how to make this work with a four-dimensional theory at high energy. There is still stuff that doesn't decouple, but it's not as radical as Kaluza-Klein states. It's just some extra fields, such as to add up to an n equals 4 gauge theory. So this is where we are. Let me summarize. The theories for which a Tufts program is realized, for which you can use string theory to calculate, are theories whose running coupling looks like this, where there can be interesting dynamics at low energy, but at high energy, it's strongly coupled. These are very crude models of real QCD. The theories for which you can quantitatively couple are still rather different from real QCD. It's interesting to look at them. Strassler and I are looking, for example, at deep and elastic scattering in these theories. It's interesting both for the ways in which it's like real QCD, but also for the ways in which it's different. And for now, the theories in which you can calculate, again, don't likely teach you much about real QCD. To decouple the extra matter, to pull the curve down to here, we have to face the question, can we actually say something about the strongly coupled 1 plus 1 dimensional theory of the string? We've traded a 3 plus 1 dimensional strongly coupled problem for a 1 plus 1 dimensional strongly coupled problem. That sounds like it might be progress, of course, because we know in many, many examples that 1 plus 1 dimensional strongly coupled theories can be understood. Not this one yet, but again, there's reason to hope. There is no reason, especially given now the successful examples, there is no reason why Tufts' conjecture can't be realized for real QCD. So I want to close by saying something relevant. Yes?
Can you add in matter fields in the fundamental representation to actually see the
Yes.
confinement going on?
There are a variety of ways to do this, yes. You can always put in source quarks.
Sure.
You can also put in dynamical quarks.
Why don't you put in dynamical quarks?
In shorthand, this whole system I'm talking about basically is D3 brains. And if you add D7 brains, that adds in the quarks, because the strings that stretch from a 3 brain to a 7 brain, the 3 brain index is color and the 7 index is flavor. So there's actually a large number of constructions for adding quarks. That's sort of the simplest.
When you add quarks like that in this language, does that add more non-decoupling stuff?
It would always sort of add either a full n equals 4's worth or maybe an n equals 2's worth, but an n equals 2's worth in some kind of scale invariant combination. It's always sort of complete multiplets of some larger supersymmetry.
But yeah. Low
n
mass.
It's n squared. It's always an adjoint worth of extra states. There's no examples in which you can get a scale invariant theory with a good dual where you balance n squared against n, right? Yes, Krishna.
Returning to the pure glue,
mm-hmm.
in the case where m is equal to lambda, roughly.
Yes.
So in real QCD without quarks, the theory describes some set of blue balls in some spectrum.
Yes, yes.
Here you have a bunch of other states which are sort of M-like states.
Yes.
They're simply mixed among each other, or is there any way of...
Well, in many cases... let me see.
And I guess what I'm really getting at is with quarks, because with quarks, if you have parallel symmetry breaking, then you have one light guy named a pion who is much, much lower than all the blue balls.
Right, right.
And I'm wondering whether in a theory with quarks, you can make the Goldstone goes on to light a Of course, you will have, if they're Goldstone bosons, they will be light, but whether you can have only the right Goldstone boson, or whether you always get wrong Goldstone bosons, too.
This is a good question to which I don't know the answer. In principle, you could probably find examples in which the massless part is QCD, that is, it's pions, which is kind of cheap because pions you just need to know the same before anyway. But there's no reason in principle you couldn't have a theory whose very light is content, whose pions were identical to QCD. Yeah, I don't know of examples. People have not worked really hard on building in the quarks. Actually, baryons are an interesting story because baryons in the large and limit have order n quarks. So they are qualitatively different from mesons. Mesons are little strings. Baryons are D brains wrapped on, you know, spheres and stuff. So there's lots of bits of this which have not been developed in full detail just because it's not QCD. And you do it only if you think you're going to get an interesting answer. I did want to talk about Rick physics briefly. So when you collide a couple of hadrons at high energy, the obvious guess as to the total cross-section is that the total cross-section is just the geometric size. They interact if they touch, and they don't if they don't. But in fact, the data show that the cross-section grows slowly with energy, and this has always been kind of a puzzle. There is actually a semi-rigorous bound from analyticity and other constraints, which says that the cross-section can't grow any faster than the log squared of the energy. The Froissart bound. Totally rigorous? Okay. Okay. Well, in fact, when these things collide, if you go over to the dual string description, when they collide at high energy, the final state is dominated by black holes. And again, these are not black holes that a four-dimensional gauge theorist calls a black hole. Four-dimensional gauge theorist calls it just a ball of quarks and gluons, in fact. But over in the dual gauge, dual string description, in fact, where you do have gravity, where the gravitational field is some kind of composite built out of your original gauge stuff, the final state is dominantly black holes. And it's some kind of black hole which is, again, you know, it's a five-dimensional black hole, has an extent in the four dimensions and also in the radial dimension. And recently, Steve Giddings and also Giddings and Erdley have shown that the cross-section for this process, in fact, over on the supergravity side, exactly saturates the Froissart bound. So you get a rising cross-section, and you are making black holes. And in fact, that's what a quark gluon plasma is in the dual string theory.
Cross-section is not the most interesting thing.
Ah, well. Maybe.
Metaphorically.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, because this is a cartoon of QCD and not quantitatively QCD, there's a limit to how far one wants to push this, but one could actually try to see one could ask what else comes out of this. And just out of more, it's more for curiosity than an expectation that it will match in detail. Yeah. Okay, so that's what I have to say.
You mean to suggest that?
So,
I mean, I like to just push this.
Mm-hmm.
About that. In connection with Rick, so you have a black hole, sort of like a fireball, and emits thermal radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Would this tell you that the temperature was dependent on the energy, as opposed to being fixed?
Yes. Now, again, the scalings will not be the same as for a four-dimensional black hole because there's not the obvious statement that the temperature falls as 1 over the mass. But yes, it does say that you have to be careful because QCD has a characteristic energy scale. There's a characteristic scale coming from this. I don't know, in short, what the answer is, Right. Black holes have the distinctive property that their temperatures fall with their mass in a well-defined way.
It would be very different than expectations from the courtroom.
Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, if you take the case which didn't work by oral language, so the M was much larger than the lambda.
Yes.
And then we didn't learn anything about QCD from the string theory. But now we know something about QCD, at least in the ultraviolet.
Right, right.
So, of course, QCD has all its inherent problems, but can the things we know about QCD in the ultraviolet tell you something interesting on the string theory?
That's a very interesting question, which, in fact, tomorrow's seminar is sort of about, although rather roundabout. Right, because the answer is yes. It's that because we know that it's dual to weakly coupled gauge theory, this should tell us something about strings in a highly curved space. And in fact, these dualities have already taught us things running in that direction about certain space-time singularities. So things where you have a space which you think is singular, and then you go ask the gauge theory what's happening, and then you come back and you find out the space is really non-singular, the physics is really non-singular in any case. I think it's a really interesting question which I've been trying to gear up to actually try to take what you said and make it precise, that is to actually do calculations in the gauge theory and relate them to precise amplitudes in the string theory. Yes, there should be something along those lines.
The other question, when you said I'm going to talk about Rick physics,
yes.
I wasn't expecting scattering theory. I was interested, but I thought you were going to say finite temperature, which is another thing you might talk about, which is it's not Rick physics literally.
Oh, sorry.
Equilibrium quantum field theory at a high temperature, where the gauge theory becomes 3 plus 0 dimensional, despite
yes.
Go to Euclidean space first and then take the extent of the fourth the Euclidean dimension small because of high temperature.
Yes.
Can you say anything there?
Yes. In fact, the supergravity side has two phases. There's a low temperature phase in which the gauge theory would just have a gas of hadrons,
yeah.
And the string theory just has a gas of strings, or mostly the massless strings, the gravitons.
The question is, can you split T between
yes.
lambda and M?
And then there's a transition. And well, you don't even need to do that. There is a transition, even keeping M there.
There's three scales.
There's a transition.
There's three scales, lambda, T, and M.
Right. No, you can't. There's not room to put T between there.
Yes.
But when T is when T is up here, you do have a transition,
yes.
And what you would call the quark gluon plasma is again on the supergravity side an extended black hole.
It's the quarks plus the M stuff.
The quarks plus the M stuff goes over to is dual to a black hole. Yeah. And in fact, there's one of the many nice calculations. There is a nice the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole matches in terms of its parametric dependence to that of the plasma. There's a famous factor of 3/4, which is just sort of some renormalizations. It's nothing that is a problem, but this, in fact, you might think that a 10-dimensional theory would have a free energy that has the wrong power of temperature because it's 10-dimensional. But because of this position-dependent gravitational redshift, the partition, it doesn't behave like a flat 10-dimensional space. And the partition function has the same scaling with temperature as the gauge theory does. The entropy goes as T cubed and so on.
Modulo
the 3/4, which Kirk discovered.
No, but I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It's something
yes.
which is one of these world sheet recoupling versus strong degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So do I understand right if you take the equation of state in gauge dynamics and transfer in for string theory, you get the Hawking expression for the entropy?
Yes, in there's a numerical coefficient. So, the entropy of a gauge theory, you've got n squared fields, and the three dimensions. So dimensionally, it's t cubed. And there's a coefficient. This pretty much has to. I mean, this is not such a deep check. It has to work based on symmetries and counting. But in fact, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for the black hole, the horizon area in units of the Planck scale. Is again some dimensionless number times n squared times t cubed. The two dimensionless numbers differ by a factor of 4/3, which is not a problem because, again, this is a calculation which is valid in weak coupling. This is a calculation which is valid in strong coupling. The entropy is not one of those things which is protected from quantum corrections by supersymmetry. So this is something which, amusingly, you know, it's some function which is 3/4 when it's zero. And it's 1 when it's infinity.
Some enterprising people have started
Ah, and yes, and some enterprising people have calculated the first correction there, and the first correction there, and they start to come together. And you know, in principle, if you cared enough, you could put this on a big enough computer and just Monte Carlo it, and you should get that curve.
Question. I'm curious what you think about attempts to explain the connection between the string theory and the chemical for young males, semi-classical. There are instantons whose internal space is this interdisciplinary type space.
I have not followed that in detail. And I understand that there may be parts of the real QCD phenomenology which are instanton dominated, and so that seems like an interesting point of contact. But I have not. That's a corner of the subject I haven't followed, but it is remarkable that there are calculations in the gauge theory which see the. I mean, it's not remarkable because it's in some sense predicted by supersymmetry, but there are explicit calculations in the gauge theory where you say the ADS5. Emerges as a moduli space. Yes, yes. I mean, instantons are points, so they should probe something, and the only thing they have to probe is right, ADS5.
They have scale law, and that precisely is the fixed coordinate.
Ah, okay. And yes, yes. Sorry, I mean, they're D instantons are points in the dual theory. Yes, yes, yes.
So restriction that the string theory should be 10-dimensional.
Yes.
Partly based on trying to expand from a weakly coupled string theory.
Yes.
Now, you don't expect QCD necessarily to be described by weakly coupled string theory. Is that correct? So maybe it doesn't have to be a 10-dimensional.
Good. A Tufts argument is that a Tufts argument which relates the string coupling to 1 over n argues that, in fact, you can, you know, get that you can, in fact, relate a weak, that you can take the coupling to 0. There's a way to take the coupling to 0, which is take n to infinity. So it should be given by some string theory which does have a perturbative limit. One of the things that we've learned out about the dualities is that there are theories whose lightest structures are one-dimensional. You call them string theories, but which live in other dimensions, especially 6. And unfortunately, because they don't have a weakly coupled limit, we know very little about them. They're called the little string theory is the main one. And so we know a lot about corners of the theory, but we don't have a path in a representation where we just, you know, the constructions are indirect. But happily, QCD should be described by a nice string theory because we do have this parameter n that we can vary.
You say that there is no bottoms in the string theory. How one can understand this, that in deep and elastic you will have hard scattering?
Good. It's because of the following. So, roughly, this is heuristic, but it gets the ingredients right. So this, again, is the radial direction. And because of the gravitational redshift, in particular, the effect of string tension is very large out here and very small out here. And if I'm in a if I have a string, which is, again, I'm now is interested in a limit where the radius curvature of the space is rapid compared to the size of the string, this string is going to feel a rapidly varying gravitational redshift from one side to the other. And it seems plausible that the dynamics is dominated by, as the parameter becomes more and more extreme. I'm now talking about R over L string goes to 0, the weakly coupled limit where you see the partons. It is plausible, in fact, that in this limit, the dynamics of the string is more and more dominated by the points of largest gravitational redshift. And you can do calculations not in this limit, in the other limit, where you don't see partons, but what can happen is as you go to larger and larger radius, the whole string gets small because its tension is growing due to the gravitational redshift. And so you have behavior which is much harder than you expect in string theory. For elastic scattering, where the whole string scatters as a unit, the scattering is very much as in QCD. But to actually get partons, where different subsets of the string scatter as units, you need to go to this limit where the gravitational redshift has a large gradient. And then you can imagine that this is happening, but there's no calculations yet.
So you're saying partons would be just little segments of
it. Partons would be little segments, yeah. It's neat because you kind of know what the answer is. It's just a perturbative gauge theory, but so far it hasn't been enough to actually, you know, solve the theory. No questions? Oh, thank you.